Okay, welcome back. Another episode. We are here with the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast, episode 45. Starting us off today, our second most gray-haired man on the pod, Brian, talk to us about the silver tsunami.
It's a, you know, Tucker, thank you. It's a topic that's near and dear to me. See, now I've now entered the, you know, the late middle stages of my life, but I was in a presentation or listened to a presentation this week, and it was just fascinating. So I thought it'd be a good topic to talk about. And it is the silver tsunami. And at the high level of it, there will be, 150 million jobs shifting to workers 55 plus by 2030, right? So, right now, about 14% of the workers are 55 plus, or, and I shouldn't say that right now, but in 2002, 14% were 55 plus. By 2032, it'll be 24% of the entire workforce is 55 plus. And why is this? Why is there more people in the workforce? One is, the life expectancy is increasing. And it's not just life expectancy, it's how healthy people are into their 70s, right? And there's been a lot of studies saying that if people who continue to work, continue to stay active, continue to work out and keep routines into their later stages, they live longer, they live healthier, and they live happier, right? So a big part of that is work, right? So there's going to be this extension of people working into their 70s that are pushing, within organizations that are pushing those numbers higher, right? And granted, the size of the population is smaller, but the fastest growing age group, in the workforce right now is 75 plus, right? And then, okay, very small population as compared to the overall workforce. I get it. But the second largest, age group in the workforce is 65 to 74. Right. So it just gives you directionally where a lot of growth is coming from in terms of our workforce population. And you start to think about, okay, organizations, what's the number one risk to, if you ask Fortune 500 CEOs, what's the number one risk to organization? It's talent. There is a war for talent. There's a war to retain talent. And there's a war to grow organizations with the best available talent. Right. And if you look at other data, the population that is 65 plus within an organization, they are, across many surveys, they are the most satisfied, they are the most engaged, and they're the most loyal, right? So you've got a population that, are just true believers in that organization, are working really hard for it. There's some other data that shows a shift. Employees that are 60 years old and younger, compensation is really the focus of that employee. You hit 60 and over, it's more about feeling fulfilled in the organization, feeling like they're a part of an organization and creating an environment for the better good, right? Really, their purpose is the work, not the compensation, which for a company is really good, right? So start to think about, okay, what does that mean for real estate? Well, as you start to look at how companies really focus their portfolios, how do you create an environment for people that are working longer, working in a professional setting into later years of their life? And there's a number of things you got to start to think about, like, right? So as you start to design space, think of tech companies. They always design this like cool, young, like you got foosball tables, you got bright colors, you got games, you got slides. Like, are those where you're going to see this mature workforce working? I don't know. And if you want to attract them, you have to think through it, right? So that's a big piece of it. The other thing is around acoustics. Like, we, at this particular meeting, they did a survey of the room, and I stepped up and I said, you know, the number one thing for me as I gotten older is background noise. And the louder the background noise gets, the harder it is for me to hear the conversations that I'm having on a one-on-one basis or within, you know, Zoom or a group or something. So how do offices and how do environments create a mix between energy and excitement and something for these younger employees, but also have a environment for older people that have, you know, different challenges with stimulus, with either hearing or just focus in the work. So, I don't know. I thought it was just fascinating around, how companies are starting to look at this. And, you know, at least the clients that I've dealt with, we've really, somewhat forgotten the needs of the older workforce. It's more like, hey, you want to make sure your focus groups include our younger employees, our up and coming employees. Okay. Those are great. But really there's a whole segment, this older population that's sticking around longer that add a tremendous amount of value to an organization that you really should be thinking about. How do we create an environment that helps them?
So is the guy with the most silver, you know, I used to say you need more gray hair. Stop saying that because it'll fall out before you get it. But I think the big part of this would be to drill down and understand the why, because there's probably some segment of that group that is working because they need to. They still need the income. And then there's a segment of the population, I think I would put myself in this category, that just chooses to stick around. Like, retirement isn't actually one of the goals on my bucket list. Like, I like being engaged. I love what I get to do, frankly. So the idea that in the 50s and 60s, you know, work was hard and you look forward to the day where you got your gold watch and got to stop doing it. I wonder to the extent that's changed. And then more broadly, just this idea that life expectancy is so dramatically improved. Of course, we have to sort of alter the pattern and the model for how long one works. So there's probably an undercurrent of that that supports all of this. But I like where you're going with it. You know, this idea that the future company, the model for a growing company today is so much of, you know, kegerator and a foosball table, maybe a little off target.
I also think that the differences between these generations are not as wide as some people make them out to be. I mean, the amount of articles around the differences in generations in the workplace, I think, is very overdone. And when you actually think about the like archetypical tech company with all the, you know, benefits that they have, most older people that work at those companies really enjoy them, right? Like, having free nutritious lunch, having a gym, having childcare, having things like that. Like, no one, maybe you don't use all of them, but no one is complaining about having these perk packages. And I think that in general, the kinds of people that work at that are older, that are part of, you know, the silver tsunami or whatever we want to call it, that those people that work at these companies generally really enjoy being around the energy of younger people. In other words, you don't have a, you know, 65-year-old that is knowingly going to work at, you know, Nvidia or Meta or something like that, being like, oh my gosh, I'm so annoyed working with all of these Gen Z millennials. Like, you know that that's going to be the majority or a meaningful portion of the population you deal with it. And then generally, like, older people that lack technology skills don't work at companies like that. And they generally work at companies that typically don't have those perks. And they're the small and medium sized businesses that make up, you know, the vast majority of jobs that we have in the US. So anyways, anyone that's saying, hey, you know, these older people in the workforce need X, Y, and Z, and the younger people need, you know, this other set of things. I think, of course, there's differences. And as you get older, maybe you become more sensitive to sound, but nothing that a custom molded set of earplugs to your ear canal can't solve.
Yeah, and let's think about, like, I think also, Brian, when I hear that news, it doesn't really surprise me. And I think we're going to see it more often as, you know, years go by. And the reason being, I think, you know, we talked about this this morning before the pod started, is that people live longer now. There's a longer life expectancy for people today than there has been in the past. You know, we're going to continue to see advancements in healthcare, which are going to, you know, prolong people's life expectancy, and they might just want to work longer or need to save more for what is now perceived to be a longer lifespan than what they may have previously thought they were going to have. Let's also remember, there's, I think, while it is doesn't account for everybody, I think, John, you mentioned this, there's probably some financial necessity at play here as well. The 2008 financial crisis really gutted some people's retirement plans and or their personal savings if they reacted out of fear and maybe sold the bottom versus just kind of staying the course. So I imagine that's somewhat at play. And let's not also miss the fact that there's been a shift in retirement benefits. I mean, when my parents and all of our parents were, you know, growing up, you know, pensions were kind of a thing, right? Now there's been a massive shift to 401k, and which requires that, you know, people are more responsible for their retirement savings than just hoping the company is going to, you know, provide them with this pension that at age 55, 60, 65, they're going to be able to punch the clock and get that golden watch or the clock that adorns the wall and you live off the pension for the rest of their lives. You know, there's, you know, I think people are generally speaking more active these days. And I think we'll see a lot more of this. And I also think that, not to dismiss the fact that these people have, you know, 30 years plus of being in the workforce, but there is institutional knowledge that they bring to teams. You know, I think there's younger people that come straight out of college. They are flooded in with information. They have a tremendous amount of information, having learned through school and internships. They know the world, right? And then as they start to progress in their career, they start to build real knowledge with that information. But let's remember, those that have been doing this a little while start to develop wisdom. And that's not something they teach at, you know, at any of the universities, nor is it something you can acquire by reading a book. So let's give some credit to those that have been doing this a little while, that they have wisdom that the others that are younger than them will have someday as well. And I imagine that sometimes, depending on the path of your career, you can accelerate that wisdom versus others that may take a long time. But yeah, and I think there's one other point. Let's not forget too, that there's now like a delayed retirement age, you know, with Social Security being at risk. You know, you don't maximize your benefits until, what is it now, 67? I think is that what you have to wait till you're 67 or maybe even that 70 to maximize your benefits. So some people might just be, delaying that retirement and pushing the work life until they're 70 to maximize benefits. So, and we all know how expensive healthcare costs are today. You know, if you're being provided healthcare, that could be a reason as well. So lots of reasons why I'm not surprised with the data. And I think we'll see, more of it as years to come.
Yeah, it's a good point. I heard a statistic. So in 1939, when Social Security was founded, the retirement age to get benefits was 65. At that time, the average life expectancy was 62, right? So now life expectancy has, you know, gone well into the 70s. And I think you're right. It's 70 to maximize benefits. It's 67, I think, to start getting benefits, depending upon, and there's a scale there. But it, Tucker, to your point, the age is blended, and actually the scientists that study this, the only generation that's actually recognized in data is baby boomers. Everything else is just a social construct built around, and there's no exact dates. It's just built around what people and what the vibe was at that time, or what caught on. But the you know, studies have shown that 90% of workers prefer to work on multi-generational teams, and for very different reasons, as you would expect. Younger people want the experience. They want to learn. They want, you know, they want to be able to be the, as knowledgeable as the people that have been doing it longer. Or people on the inverse of that want the new energy. They want to learn from young people. They want to be a part of an organization that has energy and multi-generational. 87% of organizations believe those multi-generational teams deliver better results and are more innovative. So it's not just that it's better for the people, it's better for the organizations as well. And then there was another study done. So digital dexterity around technology, measuring the cognitive ability in social practice to effectively use and leverage media, information, and technology. The strongest age group, 55 to 74 at 92%. The weakest age group, sorry, Tucker, 35 to 44 at 76%. So, the older people within the workforce are really focused on learning and understanding technology and leveraging it in their jobs, right? So, it's just another carrot in their, a feather in their hat, around why they're great people to keep around. Organizations need to learn how to create office environments to support them. They need to create flexibility. And flexibility, I saw another stat that MIT did. Flexibility doesn't mean hybrid. Older workers want to be in the office. They want that personal connection. They want to be around people. They think that's a way to create higher productivity is to be around their coworkers. But they need to, it could be part-time, it could be, it could be, a scenario where their time is decreased over time as they continue to head towards retirement, right? So there's a decreasing scale of the number of hours required, and that is supported in the workforce. It isn't making them an outlier. But as you go to different offices, I start to think back of some of my clients and what they're designing and how they, in a meeting I was just in with a managing partner of a firm and how he was really focused on bringing young people into a steering team to help design the new office and to help understand what's important in the new office. Well, at the same time, this particular firm did not have a mandatory retirement age for partners. They let people work until they want to work. And a suggestion I'm going to have in terms of sending this data is to make sure that you're capturing that older workforce that are going to continue to stick around, because the data they have is that people age out in their early 60s, late 50s, early 60s in these firms. Well, that could have been the last 20 years or more when they started their career. But for the next 10 or 20 years, which is when this new office is going to be used, they're going to be sticking around longer. So they should be equally represented or strongly represented. They're the ones who have the clients. They're the ones who have the knowledge. They're the ones who are going to make or break the firm, in my opinion, over the next 5 to 10 years. The younger people are going to be the workhorses, and you got to be able to hire them too. But people are going to stick around longer, so you got to make sure you're putting the office in a place and in creating an environment that supports both. So just an interesting way to think about how the war for talent, or the focus on building really strong, innovative, and replenishing workforce talent in a highly competitive environment is continuing to change, and where there's an opportunity to attract and retain more experienced and senior people could be a differentiator for a lot of firms, especially in firms that gear younger. I don't know.
Okay, so speaking of wisdom, let's apply a little wisdom to correct a really misleading article out of the Los Angeles Times about adaptive reuse for these office buildings that are sitting empty. I'll just read you the headline and a couple lines from the beginning of the article. Southern California's hottest commercial real estate market is for tenants that aren't human. Where Wilshire Boulevard begins in downtown Los Angeles, thousands of miles of undersea fiber optic cables disappear into an ordinary-looking office tower. One Wilshire is the mother of all data centers in the West. Once a workplace for lawyers and other white-collar types, the mid-century office building's 30 floors are now stuffed with cables, pipes, coolers, and generators. So you read this article, you think, oh, interesting. So maybe that's what happens to all these vacant office buildings. But that's clearly not the case. It's not. Let's talk about that. Why can't we turn office buildings into data centers? And is that, in fact, One Wilshire a data center or something different? Really, I think that's misleading the article. Tucker, you must know the building. What's the history there?
Yeah, it's not actually a data center. It's one of the main backbone connections for all internet connectivity in Los Angeles. So it's what's called a Meet Me building. And there's generally a building or two like this in most major cities, and cities like New York that are, even bigger and more dense than LA. There's more of them, but generally that's where, all of the cables from other markets are coming in and then being distributed from there. So super misleading article. The idea that you can just turn any building into a data center is really misguided. mean, there's a reason that you've got Microsoft, you know, taking Three Mile Island to get 880 megawatts of power to power their data centers. Like, that's how short supplied we are on power generation for data centers in particular. I mean, keep in mind, if you're a giant manufacturing company and you're trying to get access to heavy power in a state, generally you're going to be able to get it because the economic impact of having a ton of manufacturing jobs in a state is very high on the communities. Whereas data centers are generally pretty low in terms of density and don't offer that many jobs for the community. And a lot of times, depending on the specialization of a data center, you might not even have people, you know, in the spot where you're, you know, acquiring power inexpensively that can even do these data center jobs, which are pretty specific. So yeah, the Los Angeles Times has no idea what they're talking about. You know, believe us when we say that if there was a like solve for turning office buildings into something useful, then everyone would be doing it. And the fact that most of these office buildings are just sitting vacant tells you everything you need to know. There really is not an easy solution, whether it's data centers or multifamily or life sciences or what have you. There's just not some silver bullet to fix this issue.
You hit on a good point. Interesting. So Microsoft goes to, what is it, like Constellation Energy, who owns Three Mile Island. And the thing's been shut down for 5 years. It's the site, and it's not the reactor is not one of the ones that is getting turned back on. It is the site of the, you know, the largest nuclear meltdown in U.S. history. And it was, you know, just a very close to being a catastrophic meltdown, because of human error. But instead of building a new power plant, instead of building new, and this is my biggest problem with the United States sometimes in our regulatory environment. Instead of taking, and I know each of you have clients or prospects in the nuclear industry that are coming up with this amazing new technology, micro reactors, small unit reactors, a lot of just new tech in these new gen nuclear power plants that are way safer, typically come with self-containment domes built into at construction that can, you know, avoid any type of a release in the event of a catastrophic failure. Nope, not going to build one of those, not going to use new technology. We're going to go turn on Three Mile Island, which is synonymous with the worst meltdown in U.S. history in 1979. And Microsoft's going to guarantee that plant buying their power for the next 20 years. So it's not like they're turning it back on for short term. That's 20 years of having that thing ramp back up instead of using new technology. And the number one reason is because of the regulatory environment of our country. It would take 20 years to get a new power plant permitted. So it's easier for them to just turn back on something that's sitting there that's old Gen 1, Gen 2 technology. It's just craziness to me. But to your point on the co-location meet me spaces, there's one in Boston here. It is a necessary evil to work with them. There's a building that's not even a nine iron away that has tried to attract some of the demand. They have some of the cables that dead end in this building, or at least pass through this building. And it's a fraction of the city of Boston's demand because it just doesn't have the connectivity to be able to support it. They charge the building that does have it. They charge anything they want. I have a large telecommunications client here that has to be in the building. And what you do is you try to create as much capacity outside of it as you can, but you still need to do it because it's where, it's where everything dead ends. So it's not a data center. And, using office space would be great for data centers if you had a way to get the power there, to Tucker's point, but we don't.
Yeah, it will be really interesting to see what happens. I mean, if you think of alternative forms of energy in the U.S., we basically have not constructed at any reasonable level of volume nuclear reactors for the last several decades now. And you start thinking about the amount of innovation that has come to, say, like solar panels and other, you know, wind energy, things like that, other types of clean energy solutions like nuclear. We've had multiple decades of iteration of making these products better, you look at the efficiency ratings of solar panels from, you know, 30 years ago versus today, right? It's like a just astonishing difference where solar panels are getting so much better every single year that there were times where it's like, hey, maybe don't even buy solar panels right now, because the amount of solar panels you'll need to generate that same amount of energy next year with the predicted advancements is so much higher. And I predict that that will happen with nuclear. I mean, as Brian said, I mean, we're really excited to be working with a number of the sort of next generation nuclear companies, and the reactors that these companies are building are amazing. But I think the downstream effects of these things are not something that many people are thinking about right now. If you're a manufacturing company trying to get power in, you know, name a state that's good for manufacturing, whether it be, you know, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, you know, the Arizona, like, you know, the usual suspects where you see a lot of manufacturers end up being located, to get power, to get like orders of magnitude, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 megawatts to a site for manufacturing, you are completely beholden to whoever the power company is. Sometimes there's two, but in most instances, there's only one power company. And what these companies will say is, hey, if you want to have more than 10 or 15 megawatts to your building, then you need to build a substation on your site. And the timeline to build substations in most parts of the country are between 3 and 4 years. And it's just like, hey, sorry, too bad. Like, it is what it is. If you don't like it, then you have no other option. So you think of this like customer-centric experience that exists in a lot of other industries, particularly around constructing buildings where you have a, you know, end user in mind that's, you know, paying meaningful dollar for the building. These utilities, monopolies, have no competition. They just say, hey, it is what it is. Sorry. And not to say that they're not trying to do a good job, but they have so much demand for what they're doing that they just can't reasonably accommodate people. And what will happen as you see, you know, nuclear energy get turned back on, you see, you know, small scale nuclear reactors that might be in the 5 to 25 megawatt range. You see more forms of energy being connected directly to projects instead of through, you know, a grid system. It's going to, one, reduce the amount of demand that the traditional utilities have for their power, because now there's a competition that exists. But because of that reduced demand, hopefully it spurns them to be a little bit more competitive around timing and deliverability, not necessarily on a cost standpoint. And then because of that reduced demand, they will hopefully be less busy and be able to bring these insane lead times from 3 to 4 years down to a year. At least that's the hope. I think it's a reasonable conclusion to think that that will happen, just a matter on what timeline.
Yeah. And I think the premise of this article, it will, if we can do that and we start to bring in these other forms of energy, it will unlock office buildings. I don't know about downtown office buildings, but it will unlock office buildings for other uses like a data center, right? If you bring in, there's a company here in New England called Electric Hydrogen. It's creating green hydrogen, and their power generation's 100 megawatt power generation. You can stack them. So you could buy 5 of their units and get 500 megawatts. Now, as you start to think about those being commercially viable in terms of the price of the energy they create, put those next to an office building. Yes, you could then bring in the HVAC capacity. You could in the connectivity, like there's a lot of pieces of it, but some of these buildings already have strong connectivity. You could start to think about, we could use this building for something else if we can generate on site and it's commercially viable in terms of the pricing to do that. Right now it isn't, but between nuclear and other forms of energy, especially as you look around the country, like we're having these catastrophic storms. And if you look at some of the issues we're having down south, like some of these solar farms were significantly impacted. And it's great green energy, but is it really the right type of green energy for that area, right? If there was other options, would we have put a massive solar farm where there could be, you know, a path of a hurricane? Would we have used something like nuclear that's hardened and can be withstand these types of events, where you could then put the solar and refocus it in areas where that have a lot of sun and don't have huge weather events like the Midwest or out west? So I think that the market's coming, and it's coming in a big way. I think it's unfortunate that somebody like Microsoft, in my opinion, would you know, take the easy way out and go back to 1960s technology to be able to satisfy this instead of being a, you know, instead of being a champion of bringing some new nuclear or new hydrogen or new whatever technology to bear to, you know, to power their new AI data centers.
Good topic. Well, I got something else that will spur some discussion. I'm going to shift gears here. So last week, well, first of all, I'm going to talk about an article that was in CoStar, and sometimes I assume that everyone knows what CoStar is, but just for the disclaimer, it's a commercial real estate data and CoStar is a commercial real estate data and analytics company. It provides details on property listings, market research, market insights. It's largely subscribed by commercial real estate firms and landlords. So anyway, they had an article last week, and the article had some graphs and some statistics. And they were saying that we are seeing a substantial rise in long-term lease commitments. They've even went so far as to say that in 2024, this year, we are seeing that 10-year commitments or longer are making up for 44% of the leasing activity in commercial real estate right now, as opposed to 11% in 2023 and only 1% in 2021. So that's pretty substantial increase, right? Like in the past few years, going from 1% to 44%. And the article makes you believe that, gosh, there's, you know, 44% of tenants might be signing 10-year leases. What's going on here? And I wonder how much of this is dictated by a larger percentage of leasing than normal in new construction, which typically requires longer-term leases for the exchange for a very large tenant improvement allowance. So for example, if the overall leasing activity is still down, which I believe it is, but new construction leasing is constant or up, its percentage share would go up, right? And so I wonder if that's skewing the overall data as we see some new developments still coming online that are then therefore attracting those longer term commitments. The other thing that I was thinking might be kind of skewing the data is that while there's uncertainty in the market to some extent, some companies are looking for longer term commitments for security by locking in lease terms that are historically extremely favorable. So how much of the leasing velocity out there for those people that know they need office space are those that are like, gosh, this is cheaper than the lease that we're coming out of that we signed 5 or 7 or 10 years ago. Not to mention the landlord's giving us all sorts of concessions that are just pretty phenomenal. Like let's lock this in. And you know, is this a, you know, the other thing I was going to think about, and then I went open up for discussion here, guys, is this temporary? Is this like a temporary fluctuation right now in the market? Or is this a sign of the market shifting? Where people are like, gosh, you know, I know what I need and I'm willing to commit to a longer term because I have my work from home or work in the office plan figured out. So, you know, the leasing volume, I think, could be versus new construction volume could be distorting the growth in these long term leases as reported by CoStar. But those are my thoughts. I'd love to hear what you guys are thinking. Who wants to take this on?
I always have an opinion about things. I'll jump in. First of all, I think that the short-term leases are probably underreported. So the data is probably not a true sample size. If you have a short-term lease, you're doing a sublease, less likely that, because this is all self-reported by the brokers, right? Less likely they're going to put that into the system and be able to report on it. So, but I think there's a trend here. I think, you know, interest rates are down 0.5 percentage point, 500 basis points. Companies, you see the news that came out a month ago about Salesforce bringing people back. And then now you see Amazon bringing people back and you're seeing companies get more confident in their decision making. And there's a strong trend and there's a strong sentiment out there that people are going to be coming back to the office. So that piece of it. So companies are getting more confident in making decisions. And then I think owners, the ones that are able to do deals, they're more confident in you know, what they have and in doing transactions that make sense for everybody. So blend and extends. I was just having some conversations with some of the brokers here, and it's a simple concept. Let's blend in the new reality, what market is today, with an existing rent stream that runs through 26, 27, 28. Tenants were really loving those ideas, and landlords were somewhat resistant by and large, because they were kind of hoping for a bounce back, hoping for a change in market conditions. Well, they're getting a little bit of that now, but I think they've come to realize that the market is not going to bounce back in a massive way quickly, and locking up tenants in a reasonable transaction for companies that want to stay is something that's happening. And to do those transactions, you need to give them term. So long-term deals are required, right? So you're getting the benefit of upfront savings in return for long-term confidence in the asset. And I think both parties are kind of feeling better about where they are. I don't necessarily think the owners are feeling great about asset values, but they're at least feeling great that hopefully they can hang on to the building. The market has somewhat stabilized. It's not continuing to deteriorate in a real strong negative way. Okay, we know who we are. Tenants are like, we know who we are. Let's go do deals and let's go capture today's market in terms of adding value to our building, but also creating savings for tenants. It's a win-win. That's my take on it and why the data is supporting it.
So I'm highly skeptical of that data. I'm highly skeptical of CoStar, more broadly, in case people think it's this broad clearinghouse of accurate and complete information. It is not. As Owen suggested, it's self-reported. As a firm, we generally don't report these leases to CoStar. There's no business of the CoStar to know what our client transactions look like. That's confidential information, frankly. So there's a lot of information that's not being reported. It's highly selective and subjective, those who do report. And I'm just skeptical of the data. I'll give you an example of why I'm skeptical of the data. Did you all notice that where CoStar reports, you know, tracks available inventory, right? So it remembers the date that a space was first listed as available for lease. And for as long as I've been using CoStar, we would look at that information. It would be very interesting to see that a space has been listed for a year and a half. You know, that's a lot of pain for the landlord. Maybe that indicates how willing they're going to be to negotiate, how much leverage we may have in the negotiation. But suddenly, when we look at the time on market, is how that's referred to, it no longer reports 270 days. Suddenly, it's in this category called greater than 3 months. And everything longer than 3 months gets dropped into this bucket. Like, have you seen that in your markets? It seems clear that one theory would be that that's intended to be less harmful to the building owners, who are some of CoStar's largest customers, to not be highlighting the fact that the vacant space has been vacant for so long and simply put it in this bucket of 3 months or longer. Have you seen that? Are you suspicious of what that is about? And what do you think?
I think that it's widely recognized that news in general is very biased depending on where you're getting it from, and that in order to get an accurate picture of what's happening, you need to get news from many different sources and kind of bring together and form your own worldview or have your own observations that aren't, you know, distorted through a bunch of people that have other agendas. And I don't mean that as a political statement. Obviously, we're, you know, in the election cycle here and everything can be construed as being political. But rather, I just mean in the context of commercial real estate, CoStar is sort of the ubiquitous, most successful aggregator of data. I mean, it's essentially the commercial version of the MLS. And there's a handful of other companies like LoopNet that people are familiar with that CoStar actually owns. There's not really a viable competitor to CoStar. I mean, I would say that it is probably the most monopolistic entity that you have in the commercial real estate ecosystem. And of course, like most things in the commercial real estate world, everything revolves around owners of buildings. I mean, the brokerage companies, as we've talked about, predominantly revolve around servicing landlords versus tenants. It's no surprise that the data aggregators are doing so as well. So when you see CoStar make these small changes, like changing the listing to say available for greater than 3 months instead of available for 32 months or something that makes it look like they're probably desperate, of course, that is bias seeping into the process. The other thing too is that the people that report transactions are predominantly landlords trying to set a market that's favorable to them. Guess what? Landlords aren't going to report bad transactions if they don't have to. And brokers on the tenant side generally aren't going to report transactions that are really competitive too, because they don't want to get their client in trouble and breach an NDA for a transaction that a landlord doesn't want publicized. So I think the whole real estate ecosystem on the commercial real estate side, where transactions are not publicly recorded, is very there's a lot of murkiness. It's extremely opaque, and you really don't know what's happening by just reading articles. You have to be doing transactions every single day to actually know. And the takeaway for people that listen to this podcast, you know, whether it be, you know, directors of real estate or other brokers or whomever, is if a landlord sends you an article citing CoStar data saying, hey, according to CoStar, this, this, and that, it might not be true. And just keep in mind that, you know, who these data providers generally serve. And it's not to help tenants get lower lease rates. It's to help landlords get higher lease rates.
I couldn't agree more, Tucker. I mean, think about this for our listeners, okay? In the world of residential real estate, and I imagine many of our listeners have bought or sold residential real estate, transparency allows buyers or sellers to see exactly how long properties have been listed, right? Like when you go on Redfin, for example, you can see this property's been on the market for 49 days. Having that information, at least for me, when I'm a buyer, enables me to make informed decisions. I like that. So the question I have for, you know, is why is the world of commercial real estate moving further into opacity? We are a very opaque industry, unlike our you know, counterpart, residential. And I think the answer is very, very clear, and Tucker hit on it, which is that who are CoStar's biggest clients? They're the landlords and their agents. Those are the biggest clients that CoStar serves. And they're probably, and I'm speculating, encouraging CoStar to bury this information that was once available. Literally a month ago, I could see how long a property was available, even if it was upwards of 3 years. And now it says it's maxed out. It says over 3 months, but it won't say anything beyond that. And so think about it. If you're a tenant or a director of real estate that has access to CoStar, or you're asking your broker to tell you, how long has this been on the market? You know, if a tenant notices a space has been available for 3 years, the obvious questions that come to mind is there a problem with the space? Is the building in disrepair? Is there something wrong with the landlord? Can we achieve some amazing discount given the fact that it's been sitting on the market for three years? Those are questions the landlords and their brokers don't want you to be asking. They don't want you to know that information. So it only makes sense. And again, some of this is speculation, but all I can say is that to, you know, John's point, we don't see this information anymore. All we see is it's been vacant for more than 3 months. I think it's wrong, and I wish we didn't operate in such opacity in this industry.
Ryan, you going to correct us? Because
no,
we can still get the data. We just have to do an extra step and run a report, and it's not on the surface level.
Exactly. The data is still in there. You can get it. But it's unbelievable where this is going. But I think it's simpler than this, right? To me, it's the landlords, yes. But a lot of the a lot of the blame or a lot of the pressure is coming from the large brokerage firms, and here's why. And I bring this up because we've been having a lot of conversations with companies who have had subleases listed on the market, and there's no activity. And not only is there no activity, there's no brochure on CoStar, there's no floor plan on CoStar, there's no pricing on CoStar. Right. So the model, and I think this is why I think it's simpler. The model at the major brokerage firms is volume. Get as many clients as you can, throw all the information on CoStar and let the market come to us. Right. You end up on, we'll end up, if as long as it's on CoStar, we'll get on the survey and we'll have our chance to sell them on the suite once they tour. Well, one of the brokers here just did a survey, 15,000 feet. There was like 50 options. Do you really think you're going to make the survey when you have, what's the right rate? Unavailable. Okay. Where's the floor plan? I don't know. I reached out to the broker. He hasn't got back to me yet. Okay. Where's the brochure? There isn't one on CoStar yet. Have they been sending one around? No. Okay. Take it off the list, because at the end of the day, like, there's so much out there. You're never going to be able to go to every broker. You're not going to be able to go chase everything down, and your client's asking for information. Well, they're not that serious about subleasing it if their team isn't putting the information out. So that one gets pulled off the list, and then it just sits and it sits, and then they're waiting for the market to come to it. Okay, now you pick your head up. We're 2 years into a terrible market cycle where there's a ton of real estate on the market, and they're looking at dates that are like listed for 24 months, listed for 27 months, listed for 18 months. Oh, we better get to CoStar and stop pulling that out of that. It makes us look really bad if a firm who looks at the project of subleasing differently and is very proactive and goes out and just like really, really focuses on me as a client and brings attention to these subleases that have been sitting out there. Wow, we're looking really bad. We better go to them and change the way the data is presented so people don't see as easily that, you know, we haven't been doing our job. And that's, to me, it's simple as that. It's a way for the brokers to continue to be lazy, to continue to look at this as an inbound tool to get on a survey rather than an outbound tool to be able to go find deals. And I'll give you one example. I'm working on a really large project for a client. It's a sublease. And I had my team pull together, what's every tenant in the market that's expiring between now and 2028? Okay, here's the list. Go to the client and say, I want to send, and I won't give particulars, but I want to send unsolicited proposals to these five companies because of these reasons. Now, their lease doesn't expire for a number of years, but there's no demand in the market. Guess what? We're in design with that company right now for the full building, right? They're not in the market. They haven't started a process yet, but the opportunity is too great for them not to pass up because of the value for them in particular, right? So to be really aggressive, to really understand what your client has as an asset, and then to go find people in the market that need that, there's tremendous value in that. And that's not what the big firms can do because they just have too much on their plate, too many subleases, too many listings. And in response, you remove the data so no one knows how long it's been sitting for. That's their answer to the problem. Not working harder or working smarter.
That's just good old fashioned brokerage, Brian. And taking the initiative and going and finding a solution. Well done. What I was going to suggest is, you know, consider the context in which this is happening. This idea of the increasing opacity. I don't know if you're all having this experience. We're living in a market where there's two competing worldviews about where we are in the cycle and what happens next. There's a increasing volume of folks reporting on, we've hit the bottom, we're starting to turn, we're seeing optimism, and you know, like we've made it through this cycle. And then there's a competing narrative that says, oh no, there is a lot more pain to come. A significant portion of leases have yet to expire and roll and be adjusted, and there's more vacancy coming. You know, this we've talked about it so much. There's the top 2% of the market that remains in high demand, and then there's this languishing majority otherwise at a time when asking rents haven't changed, and yet the market has radically declined for all those other 98% of the buildings. So in this market, where market rents are unestablished, we have really competing narratives. Where are we? And so in that context, to then disguise or make it harder to discover just how long a space has been vacant. I think it's about trying to put your, you know, balance thumb on the scale as to whose narrative is going to emerge as the winner, although the market will dictate. Let's find out. I think there's still some pain to come in the office sector.
You just hit on a point that I thought was interesting. You still think there's pain to come in the office sector. And it's interesting because does that mean there's going to be a lot more deals happening? There's going to be more deals happening at pricing that the market hasn't tested yet? Or there's going to just be more volume at the pricing that the market has tested? There just hasn't been a lot of deals done at, right? Because I don't believe the market's going to continue to fall much further than it has in the markets that I've operated in. I think there's been pretty significant net effective rent corrections in most markets. I just don't think the volume is there to support it. So the data doesn't show that. But when you're living and breathing it, I think the data needs to catch up. But I think actually in the market today, we're at pretty close to the bottom. I think we're at bottom but the data isn't showing it because there's just not enough activity yet for it to catch up. I don't know what you guys think on that.
Well, so I wonder if it's market by market. For example, in San Francisco, in the San Francisco office market, those the rents have declined. They're responding to the change in the marketplace. In San Diego, we have an example where an office building just traded in distress at $80 a square foot. And I've got a client that's looking for 30,000 feet. And we approached that building owner and thought, okay, here's a group that can transact at the current price level. Oh no, $325 monthly rent. You know, they're not lowering their asking rent in spite of their reduced basis in the building. So I suggest to you that in this market, we're seeing a lot of still pre-capitulation. The market has not capitulated yet. It sounds like in Boston, you're seeing landlords that are transacting at what you would deem to be of an appropriate price level today. We've got a lot that are not in our market.
Yeah, I think a lot of it too depends on the market, right? So we're speaking in macro terms, and there are markets that differ substantially from one another across our country right now. San Francisco, and I hate to pick on San Francisco because we have in the past, but right now, vacancy, so not availability, which would be even higher, but vacancy is at 37%. That's absolutely astonishing to me. If you think about it, you know, and you look at the beautiful skyline that makes up San Francisco, and you look at that and you go, gosh, 37%, more than a third of all the office towers are vacant. Again, that's not availability, which would be higher, which would be like, for example, a sublease. Vacancy is literally what it says, vacancy. Whereas you look at New York, and New York's expected to end, you know, metro-wide around 17% vacancy at the end of this year, which is kind of the trailing three-year average for New York. And so it's, you know, 17 is a lot different than 37, okay? So I think it, you have to, there will be markets where, yes, has the bottom already hit? Probably, maybe. I don't know. Well, you only know when, you know, once you look back in time. But I do believe, yes, there's still some pain to come for certain markets. And then you could go down really micro and just look at it as per buildings, right? Like there are buildings that have experienced a lot of pain and will probably experience a lot of pain if they indeed keep the lights on, even. I think there's some that just may not survive. So I think it's hard to generalize this across the nation, and rather needs to be taken on a more of a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, but you're making my point in the sense that looking at, I think, you know, as you look at data, you throw out the highest and the lowest. Let's not talk about San Francisco, and let's like not talk about, I don't even know, what's the best market? I can't even say Boston or Cambridge anymore. That used to be the best market because life science is so bad. But, you know, let's throw out the best and the worst and look at everything else. I think to a certain extent, those markets are what they are, and they've gotten to the point where they're going to get to. I don't know, unless the economy falters, but we've been talking about a pullback in the economy for a long time. The Fed just dropped interest rates 500 basis points. That is not a small decrease in, you know, in the rate. And I think that's going to supercharge a lot of companies to start thinking differently and spending money differently. I don't know. So I think, are we there yet in terms of the pain that landlords feel? Maybe not. But in terms of tenants and our ability to transact in assets that we want to transact in and do deals and where we want to do deals, I'm not sure there's downside, continued downside pressure for companies beyond where we are today. Now, sometimes you have to move to be able to capture it, right, John? There's landlords that are still living in 2019 and are hoping you don't spend the capital to move or go through a process to at least explore that. But for companies that are, for landlords that have vacancy and companies are willing to explore that vacancy in the marketplace, I'm not sure it's going to get any better. That's my opinion. Just, and I'm doing deals, you know, probably 10 cities right now, and each of them has their own little spin on it. San Francisco, downtown San Francisco is not one of them. But every one of them has, it feels like there's an uptick in demand across those markets, and not in demand in terms of tenants active, of deals that are done that we can report on, which I think feel is different than it ever was. And New York's one of them. The sentiment in New York, people are coming back and the market is potentially hit bottom for product that companies want. That's the difference. Like, there is a certain third of the market that no one's ever going to go back to in New York, in my opinion. But for the stuff that people want to be in, I feel like it's back. I don't know.
So, Brian, let's talk about the percentage of the market that you say no one's going to go back to. I guess before we do that, to answer John's very generalized question of, is there more pain or not? I think that we already reached the bottom of the market for Class A office space a while ago, and the data has caught up and has proven that there's generally been appreciation for Class A plus, you know, well-located buildings that people want. That's already happening. I think there is more pain for Class B commodity office space that people don't like. Those leases are going to continue to expire. People are going to have a hard time getting people to go back to those offices. I think I would describe that as the 30% of New York or whichever other city we want to talk about where you don't think people are going to come back. So if generally speaking, I think most of us on the podcast believe that office occupancy or office utilization rates are going to improve over the next 5 years and somewhat normalize, below before the pandemic, but not, you know, as low as where it is now. So if that's true, don't you need that 30% that the alleged, people are never going to go back to? And if you don't, then wouldn't that put an enormous amount of pressure on the existing inventory and that would increase Class A rents even further? Because we all know that the economics of building more office space in basically every major MSA in the country just doesn't really make sense. I mean, in Southern California, the cost to deliver office space on a build-to-suit basis, which on a spec basis should be even higher since you have to account for downtime and extra risk and all that, is literally like double what it would be at other options in many markets. So like, that's not really a lever. There's no new Class A supply coming on the market in the vast majority of areas, unless it was already under construction or already planned, or at a small scale, like, you know, boutique Class A buildings in specific submarkets.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, Tucker. So I think companies are going to continue to gravitate towards better space. I think companies have learned that commodity B space that doesn't have any of the attributes of the things that we're talking about to attract and retain people. The fallback for companies that would have had to take that space is working from home and taking a smaller footprint. I don't think it's compromising by going into that mid-block Class B building that has very poor natural light. I just don't. So I think that's kind of my point, is that the turning of the market and the sentiment and the strengthening of how companies look at their real estate is going to start to push quality space higher, and it's going to start pushing the high quality space and high quality markets higher very quickly, right? Because that Class A plus space is going to be leased. It's going to get leased quickly, and there's nothing else behind it that's going to resupply the marketplace for it. It'll be interesting how this plays out over the next 5 years.
But therein lies the opportunity. And I think that's what developers are getting excited about right now, because when you say there's nothing behind it being the Class A space that's going to get leased quickly, we're already seeing it here in Seattle, where we're going to see Class B buildings where people are going to bet on office space. I mean, that sounds crazy coming from, you know, what has been the past 4 years and work from home. But, you know, I always say that landlords like to lease space based on their optimism, not so much the statistics that dictate what decisions should be made. And what I mean by that is that you typically see, you know, I've experienced landlords where statistically you're like, your building's half vacant, you know, you're in a market that's a third vacant. Why are you promoting these terms when they're more expensive than your competitive set? And they cite things like, well, hey, Amazon's coming back 5 days a week as of January 2nd, and they're the first of many to follow suit. Now, is that speculation? Of course, but developers are constantly speculating on where the market is going to be and what's going to happen. So I think what you're going to start to see, because Tucker, you're right, you are going to need some of that Class B product to satisfy the demand, because I don't think you're going to see a lot of new construction coming out of the ground in the next few years, given the costs. I think you're going to see buildings that are Class B commodity, maybe some that were bought out of a deed in lieu of foreclosure. You know, take a building that needs a little work, instead of having to build a new building, they just amenitize and recreate what's existing. And let's remember, like, the majority of your time in the office space is within your four walls. So the extent that the landlord can give you a substantial tenant improvement allowance, you can make office space in a B building really, really cool. And if the landlord has done their job of trying to increase the attractiveness of what is provided outside the four walls, usually on the ground plane or in a tenant amenity center floor, it could be pretty intriguing and will substantially be less expensive, hopefully, than, you know, that Class A plus product that is seeing all the demand right now.
Except, tell me if what you're describing is the classic process where a building that's languishing goes through a process of default foreclosure and resetting a price at some dramatically lower basis so that that new owner who is making a bet on office space can afford to invest the capital to bring it up to something that's competitive, sufficiently competitive. But that's the process of default and foreclosure that those buildings haven't yet been through. That's indicative of future pain to come. So what you're describing is a process of more problems coming. And I don't think a half a percentage point is going to save these lenders. I think that there have been so many banks kind of kicking the can down the road. And so I just think there's a lot of this still out in the future for the not Class A plus. Everything else has to resolve. It hasn't resolved, I believe.
I agree. There's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And the winners, unfortunately, are going to be winning based off someone else's misfortunes.
Well said, Owen. Thanks, everyone, for the lively discussion. Let's wrap up there. That's episode 45. We'll be back in another 2 weeks with the next episode. Thanks.